Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 5th, 2000. In the Creekside room this morning, we have Deanne Lagerquist. Today's session is titled, Called by Our Inheritance, Learning to Hear from Our Ancestors in Faith. Let's listen in.
My name is Deanne Lagerquist. These 2 weeks, I'm on teaching staff at Holden, though I'm here most of the summer with my husband, Rick Dunning, who runs the Pearl Museum, and my son, Thomas Bjorn Lagerquist Dunning, who you heard tell five jokes last night. When we're not here, we live in Northfield, Minnesota, where I'm on the faculty of St. Olaf College in the Religion Department. And for the reason for the topic that I have been teaching about these last week and this week, namely vocation and calling, is two projects I've been working on. One is my own project, which relates to vocation in this way. I'm interested in how what Luther and theologians in his lineage, what they have to offer to a conversation that also would include Dorothy Sayers. Some of you may know Dorothy Sayers as a detective novel writer. She also is a dramatist and a writer of religious essays. And then the third element in that conversation, if it ever really becomes a book, will be contemporary feminist use of the metaphor of voice. The next session in this series will look specifically at Sayers, although I may start with one little quote from her today. So I have this personal project I'm working on related to vocation. The second thing I've been working on is a Lilly Endowment-funded project. They have these going on at about 30 colleges called Theological Explorations of Vocation, which is intended in part to help students in colleges think about their life work in light of their faith and calling to serve the neighbor. So we've had the planning phase of that, and I hope in October we'll hear that we have the implementation phase of that, and if that's the case, then I'll spend the next 5 years, I hope, working with students and also faculty and staff at St. Olaf to enhance our understanding of our work as part of our vocation. Now I'll say a little more about that later. So those are two reasons why I'm interested in this topic. What I propose to do today, as the title suggested, is to talk about how we learn to hear from our ancestors in faith. The notion of call, we talked about last time, and we did this right along my little balloon from the parade, where I have it written out. We looked at the word call, and some of our contemporary popular use of that very ordinary word to come to a more robust understanding of what vocation is. Most of these evoke a response. A call generally evokes a response. A recall, sometimes we have that. You know, if they recall your car, you're supposed to bring it back, not just say, oh, that's nice. If someone calls you on the phone, you're supposed to answer them or at least listen to their message on your machine. If an announcement is made, it's meant to evoke some response. So last time we talked mostly about what the call is, what the vocation is, what Luther and other 16th century reformers help us to understand. And today we want to think about how we respond. So we're going to do that finally by looking at some examples from of biblical figures. But first, I want to lay out, I think it's 4 or 5 premises that are behind my leading us into this exercise, which I've never done before, so we'll see how it works. Okay. So the first premise is, as I've already begun to lay out, that God calls us. That as we understand vocation as a Christian concept, it's not just any voice, right? It's God's voice that calls us. And some of you have heard me read some of these before, but I'm going to point to them again, these quotations from various authors. Sam Portero, in his book, says, one's life is a response to a call, that one's life is a response to a call is the basis of vocation. That doesn't necessarily have to be a Christian understanding, that we live our lives in response. But that one's life is a response to a call from God is the basis of Christian concept of vocation. The vocational conversation extends to the whole of life, not only life's length, but its width and its breadth. So the first premise, which will be reviewed for some of you, is that vocation, this voice, it's God's voice, calls us, and what does God's voice call us to do? First of all, it calls us to wholeness, to salvation, to take up Jesus' cross, to take up our cross and follow Jesus. That's the first manifestation of vocation. The second is to bear witness. Okay, thus far, it's the same for everyone. There's a singular call for all believers. We all share in this. But thirdly, this voice, and here we might want to think of, we move a little bit to a different image of the square dance caller. All right, now you have been embraced by God. Turn to your neighbor with love. So this gives us the gift of faith, and faith then is used in service to the neighbor in many callings. And this is where the issue of how do we hear becomes particularly troublesome sometimes. Which neighbor? If you've ever been at a square dance, you know that can, you know, you get lost pretty fast. Which neighbor is it that we turn to? But we turn to the neighbor in service to use not just this gift, but our various gifts and talents and resources. So that's my first point, that if we are going to learn from our ancestors in faith how to hear, what we're hoping to hear, what we're confident that we can hear, is God's voice. And that there is a kind of common message that we will all hear. And that's first a call to wholeness, second a call to bear witness. This is the gift of faith. And then thirdly, the callings, or the call into many kinds of service. Maybe here's the point at which I should say then, that when we talk about vocation in this sense, we're talking about the whole of life, not just discussing job, and we're not just discussing family, and we're not just discussing citizenship, right? We're discussing everything. When I talk to my students at St. Olaf, I say, are the clothes you wear religious? You know, no. Well, have you made any ethical choices about them? Oh, yes. Then they begin to see the way in which even our clothing says something about how we use our gifts, right? How do we identify ourselves? How do we use our money? Those can become then a vocational choice, not simply what uniform do you wear because of the job you have. All right. My second premise, then, is that such a call requires, indeed, compels our hearing. We have to hear it, and then we need to respond. That truly hearing is a response. Now, how many of us are around small children or others? I've heard this phrase, familial deafness. You know, that. So I say, come to dinner. Yeah, I heard you. But you don't come. So, no, you didn't hear me. I said, come to dinner. That means put down what you are doing, walk up the stairs, sit down at the table, and be ready to eat, right? Or you go and say, in 10 minutes, dinner will be on the table, and then 9 minutes later you go down and say, dinner, now, right? Such a call requires a response, but requires isn't quite the right verb there. Compels, propels, evokes, draws out. But doesn't require in the sense that this part is not dependent on the next part. We have this kind of motion which is not reversible. The gift of grace is not dependent upon our response. You can't undo the gift of grace. But the gift of grace fully apprehended pushes us out. Now, since we've had the Lutheran Book of Worship, we end that, go in peace, serve the Lord, thanks be to God. You know, it's there in our liturgy, even if we don't always get it in our life. Luther liked the image of a good tree bearing good fruit. A good tree cannot help but bear good fruit. It's not a decision, it's not a choice, it just happens. Some of you have heard me talk about the river of life flowing out of me. There's no way to dam it up. It just comes. It requires a response. And the gift of faith and all these other little gifts, which may be time or money, right? Or talents, all the things that you write down on your stewardship, whatever cute name you use in your congregation, you know, whatever it is you're writing down there, all of those things come to their fullness when they are used in service to the neighbor. Okay, now here's my third premise, and this one I have said before, it is to say that we Christians who are call ourselves people of the new covenant, like the people of the first covenant, are blessed to be a blessing. It's a little different take on what vocation means. But remember the promise that was made to Abraham, the three parts, right? Land, descendants, and a blessing. Blessed to be a blessing. I think that same dynamic is at work here in a Christian understanding of vocation. We have received a blessing, a call to salvation, and these many mundane, temporal gifts. And why? In order to be a blessing, in order to use them for others, not to clutch them to ourselves, or as Craig Dyster says in his book, Growing in the Life of Faith, so our basic task is not mastery and control. It is instead trust and grateful receptivity. Our exemplars are not heroes, they are saints. Our epitome is not excellence. Our honor is faithfulness. Okay. Now, what I'm saying here then is that the gift of faith evokes gratitude and love, which we turn toward our neighbor. And I'm not going to go into this at great length, but it is worth remembering, especially for those of us who memorize Luther's Small Catechism, that this could be bringing out familiar motifs, right? First of all, where was I going to start? I said first, daily bread. Okay. In the Lord's Prayer, back here, we pray for daily bread, and we get this explanation. God gives daily bread, even without our prayer, to all people, though sinful, but we ask in this prayer that he help us to realize this and to receive our daily bread with thanks. What is meant by daily bread? Daily bread includes everything needed for this life, such as food and clothing, home and property, work and income, a devoted family, an orderly community, good government, favorable weather, peace and health, a good name, and true friends and neighbors. Now, how does God give those things? Usually, except for good weather. Right? Except for good weather, good government, health, food and clothing, home and property, most of those come to us through the work of our hands or someone else's hands. And then if we go back to all the explanations to the commandments, I'm not going to read all of these, but say, you shall not kill. We are to fear and love God. All of them start that way. We are to fear and love God so that we do not hurt our neighbor in any way. That's always the second step. First, fear and love God. Remember that it's God who calls you to wholeness. Then, there's always the negative, so that we do not hurt our neighbor in any way. But Luther, this guy who's so worried about works righteousness, who has given us this legacy of being afraid to do anything lest we think we're doing something worth noticing, right? So, oh, man, better to do nothing than to have somebody think I'm trying to call attention to myself, right? Then he says, but help him in all his physical needs. Oh, well, and he does that in every one of the commandments. Fear, love, and trust God. So that, one, you don't do something bad. And then two, the positive one is always gigantic. Just huge. Okay. So, third premise is that we are like, that this is consistent with how God has acted toward the people, toward creation from the very 12th chapter of Genesis. Okay, then the fourth. Our own hearing can be guided by the experience of our ancestors in faith, whose stories are recorded in the Hebrew Scriptures and the New Testament. So how do we hear this guidance? One of the primary ways I think that we hear is by watching how other people hear. It's the same way we learn to talk and to use a spoon and fork and to figure out how the liturgy works and to understand how to drive a car. Over and over and over, we figure out how to be human by the example of people around us. And it's the same as in our effort to learn to be faithful human beings. Now, when I say that, I want to give you this caution. I don't think that the Bible gives us a formula. The Bible never really gives you a secret decoder ring, you know, so that, or the right receiver. If I just have the right receiver and I stand in the right place and the rabbit ear goes that way and I put a little aluminum foil on it, I'm sure I'll understand what God wants me to do. The Bible does not give us that kind of advice. It's not a formula. In part because it's a record of human problem solving. It's a record of how faithful people have striven to remain faithful. And that's not a formula. And help him in all his physical needs. Whoa, it's a huge task. And you only figure it out time by time by time. The Bible is really more like autobiography than scientific history. It's not objective. It's telling us how it worked out, and we learn from the example. It's written after the fact, right? It's not a journal. So it's that sort of thing when you look back and you see how it all fits. That's what we're learning from. So I'm going to give you a very different example, and then we'll turn to these biblical texts. This is a column from Ellen Goodman. I have no idea what her religious views
are.
She's Jewish. All right. But I'm always finding in Ellen Goodman observations about life that are really useful for launching us thinking. And here's one. It's called A Commencement Day Confession. It came out the middle of June this year. By now, commencement season has peaked. The sounds of pomp and circumstance are receding. The bumper crop of caps and gowns is nearly harvested, and commencement speakers are bringing their final exhortations to the campus marketplace. By tradition, the folks who deliver the final required college lecture are people who have made it in the wider world. They are designated successes. The men and women who are through with the messy business of screwing up and growing up, of making mistakes and recouping losses. I've given my share of such speeches, though mostly to reassure graduates that these have not, I promise, been the best years of their lives. But before the robes are packed away, I want to tell about the most, well, memorable commencement day I ever repressed. Back in the 1980s, I was invited to be the commencement speaker at the University of Pennsylvania. I was, I felt sure, the first woman to make the commencement speech on that Ivy League campus since maybe Margaret Mead. But skating ahead of the cracking ice of working motherhood, is that a great image? Skating ahead of the cracking ice of working motherhood, I decided to fly down to Philadelphia on the morning of commencement. I arrived at the gate at 7 a.m. in a decaffeinated state and took my eyes off. Then, as we taxied away, the flight attendant welcomed us all into the plane to Albany. Somewhere, even in the recesses of my absent mind, the word Albany registered. And in a full-fledged panic, I was up on my feet bellowing, Albany? Albany? I swear to you that I'm not a person who makes scenes. Bostonians do not make scenes, except, of course, in traffic. But at that moment, I did a perfect imitation of a crazy person, explaining sweatily to the attendant that there were 10,000 students, faculty, family, who would enter a stadium in Philadelphia without a commencement speaker. No woman would ever be asked to speak there again. At that point, she said two crucial things. One, Miss, we can't take off until you sit down. And two, didn't anyone at the gate check your ticket? Bingo, two admissions. And so while an entire plane load of people who wanted very badly to go to Albany glared, where, oh where, was the paper bag to put over my head, I literally stood my ground. In a few minutes, and blessedly without a straitjacket, the plane taxied me back to the gate. I raced to the Philadelphia flight, prayed I would never, ever meet any of the Albany passengers again, and stopped shaking when the landing gear touched the Philadelphia runway. I never told a soul at Penn. We commenced happily, and I left with my honor and my honorary degree and my secret intact. A few days ago, a graduate of that class said she remembered what I had said at her commencement. I can't remember a thing. But I learned again that day the thin line between success and utter disaster, the way one dumb error and one desperate recovery can change everything. Some years later, my daughter decided she wanted to go to Penn. Need I say that if I'd spent that day in Albany, I would never have shown my face within 100 miles of the admissions office. My daughter, by the way, met her husband there. Had I missed the plane? I can tell this finally without breaking into hives, but it's not the only reason I share a story for this season. You see, there has to be another moral here. And now we come kind of to my point, too. Anthropologist Mary Catherine Bateson, who is Margaret Mead's daughter, by the way, gives adults an exercise I often think of this time of year. She asks us to compose two narratives of our life history. Narrative one, everything I have ever done has been leading me to where I am today. Narrative two, it's only after many surprises and choices and interruptions and disappointments that I have finally arrived somewhere I could never have anticipated. The story of life can read both ways. Young cap and gown wearers often see their elders' lives as a straight line. We need to explain exactly how it works. You make plans, you have accidents, you move straight ahead, you take a detour, you screw up, you recover, you try hard, you get lucky. A life that looks seamless from the outside feels like a patchwork quilt from the inside. You never just achieve something. Status, success, happiness, and hold it firm. You keep composing and recomposing life. So I hope the class of 2000 will forget all the advice that comes this year from 1,000 podiums. You can't protect yourself from making mistakes in life. Although I would recommend checking the sign over the doorway before you board the airplane. But you can learn resilience, and if all else fails, stand up and scream. Okay. Now, with that in mind, let's see, how are we here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. What I'd like you to do is kind of cluster yourself in threes. So we have five groups. Okay, and I'm going to have each group look at one biblical character briefly, and then we're going to talk about what we learned from that biblical character about how we hear God's voice, right? How it looks in this account. What are the things we learn about how to hear, okay? So there are enough Bibles for every group to have one, I think. And I, you know, I could divide you up, but you're grown-ups. So if we get five groups, I'll be happy. Bibles?
I'm in the middle.
Here's 1, 2, 3, 4 group. We're going to write this up where you can see it. The first group closest to the creek is Jacob. And I want you to look particularly at Genesis chapter 5, 19 to 27. 27, 5 to 10. 28, 10 to 22, and 33, 22 to 32. Okay, then the next group with Gertrude in it, I want you to look at Gideon, and that's Judges chapter 6. Okay, and you guys hear Samuel, and Now you can certainly read 4 and chapter 3. And then the next group up, yeah, here. Oh, yeah, you can be next. Look at Esther. And Esther, you want to look particularly at chapter 2, 5 to 19, chapter 4 and 6, 14 to 8. Two, and then the last group I want you to look at, three little stories in Luke. Yeah, finally a New Testament. Luke 8, 43 to 48, 17, 11 to 19, and 19, 1 to 10. Okay, so maybe the thing to do, there aren't enough Bibles to go around, you might read to each other. We'll take 10 or 15 minutes, I'll watch. You can, or but you can read it aloud. I would actually be happy if you'd read it aloud to each other. Okay, I think we probably have enough to talk about now.
Because we don't really know that, how they heard about you. We just have to say we've not enough information.
Now, as I said, I've never really tried doing this before, so I don't know what we're going to get. Except that I'm sure we'll get something. I don't think we're going to, as I said, I think we're going to find a formula that if you do A, B, C, and D, you will know what God wants you to do next year. Or even maybe tomorrow, except for the big picture, right? God wants you to do what will preserve life. Now, how did these people hear? Gideon. We all like Gideon and Samuel. Let's start with them, because we think of them as having call stories. Mostly when you ask, that vocabulary only really works with pastors. Tell me your call story. Right? And it means, tell me how you knew that you were going to be a pastor. No one ever asks me for my call story. How did you find out you were going to be a church historian? They do sometimes say, why would you want to do that? But it's a different, you know, the assumption there is not God called me to be a historian of American Lutheranism from in my mother's womb. Undoubtedly, she was reading something. I don't know what it was, some historical novel or something. We usually don't use that vocabulary of a call story for anyone except pastors. And it's a pity. In a way, it's a pity because it gives us the sense that somehow God really directs people to be pastors and all the rest of us are on our own. Right? That part of it's a pity. I think it's a little dangerous. I also don't want us to all think we're going to get a call. Well, kind of like Samuel. How does Samuel's call come? Tell us, remind us how that goes.
You know this.
You do well. Well, Samuel was dedicated to God, living in the temple, and he was called by God three times and didn't recognize the call, and went to Eli and said, you called him. He said, no, go back. And finally Eli said, listen and say, I'm hearing you, Lord. And so he heard and got the message that Eli's two sons, because of their disobedience, would perish, and Eli's house would be punished from there on in. And he didn't want at first to respond. He didn't want it. But Eli said, you know, you'll get the same prediction on you if you don't follow through. So he told him, and God blessed Samuel, and he was recognized as a prophet.
Okay, let's pick out some things there. One is resistance, right? Because Samuel is portrayed usually as a little boy, we don't think of it as resistance so much.
But he grows up through the story. I mean, he's right. A young man at this point.
By that point, he's resistant. We also have this just befuddlement. Is that right? Fud. F-U-D-D-L-D. Resistance and befuddlement are two of the ways Samuel responds to God's call. Many of us would wish, perhaps, that God would speak to us in this way. We're lying there in the temple. Well, maybe if we slept in the church building, it would help you. I mean, you couldn't escape from this prison. Well, the way you hear God is, you've got to be sleeping in the church building, because God is more likely to talk to you in church than not. Yeah, I don't think that's what's going on. But why is he in the temple? I think that's significant. You kind of skipped over that part.
Okay. He'd been dedicated by his mother. She was barren and had prayed for a child, and Samuel was the child. And at the age of three, she brought him to the temple to live there forever and serve God.
Okay, so here's some other things that are going on in that story.
Could that be a call too?
Yeah, nurture and environment, right? That he had been set aside as a Nazirite. That's the same thing that happens to Samson. It would be interesting to compare the story of Samson and Samuel, because Samson, I love to teach Samson in class, because then students have to get, not everyone in the Bible is a good example. And Samson is really not a great example, but they're both set aside. And that's not unimportant, that there's some nurture and there's some environmental factors here. There's also a guide, Eli.
In some ways, he surpasses his guide.
Right, mm-hmm. Eventually.
Yeah.
But that three times going into the temple, three times hearing the voice, sometimes, whether it's a voice direct in the sleep or some more subtle thing, you need someone to help you sort it out. To say, no, you're not crazy. No, it's not just a weird dream. It's not what you ate last night. Because there are a lot of things that make us hear voices. Right? Lots of things make us hear voices. And
Ian, would you like to tell about that?
Well, don't you think?
No, I suppose.
Desire, you know, you want to hear a voice, right?
Yeah. We talked about perhaps there was another call in that story too.
Oh, good.
Because Eli had been warned that his sons were sinning.
Right.
So God had told him that, and he chose to ignore that.
Okay, and so we might even say for Samuel, part of how Samuel hears is by what he sees, right? Because he can see that there's a need, that the Eli's sons are not up to the task. And he can see that Eli is failing. So there's that. What about Gideon? How is Gideon's call? This is another one I think we all wish. don't know if we all wish, many people wish, clear message as Gideon.
His oven catches on fire.
Okay, miraculous signs.
And an angel doing it.
Have you ever done that? Have you ever asked for, that's partly what goes on with Gideon, right, is he asks. Now, if you want me to do this, make this lamb's wool be dry. And now make it be wet. And now make it be dry and wet together. And have you ever done that?
Give me a sign. Yeah.
Give me a sign. If none of the stoplights are red, then clearly that means God wants me to go.
Find a parking place.
Right? Or money. Money, I think, is the great American fleece. If you want me to go to this school instead of that school, have the admissions people here give me more money. We're all wishing that it would be clear, and we ask for a sign. I kind of think Gideon is probably the least helpful example.
Yeah.
Because your oven catches, sometimes what seems like the clearest sign in a way is the hardest to interpret. Did you want to say something?
Well, one of the interesting things is it talks about the angel of the Lord coming to him, and he has this whole conversation, then asks for a sign. The angel grants the sign, sets the offering on fire, and only then is Gideon afraid.
Yeah. Oops.
This is kind of dumb, I think.
Right. And there's resistance again. You know, that he keeps saying, well, how about another sign? How about another sign? More sign.
He says he's the weakest and his clan is the smallest.
Yeah, there's lots of that resistance business. And, how shall I say this? Self-disqualification.
And real offering of excuses, and so as justification as to that self-disqualification. Mm-hmm. I can't do it because I'm small. I can't do it because I can't speak.
Yeah, and Moses is, of course, a prime example of this. Again, with a miraculous sign, the burning bush, which was not consumed. And there's Moses saying, no, not me. I'm not prepared. I'm not ready. This, I think, is important for us as we tend, and I certainly tend to do this, to talk about vocation in terms of what we have, in terms of our gifts. Well, I'm good at this, so certainly that's what God wants me to do. And I think the biblical accounts urge us not to be blinded by what we're good at, right? And to consider the possibility that the call will make something more of us than we are able to see. Right. And to draw out what we don't know is there. Okay, how about, let's look at Esther.
We have, in this group, we didn't finish the read.
Okay, that's fine. It's a long story.
One of us has not heard the story before.
Ah.
So is taking it in for the first time, and one of us is only slightly familiar.
Yeah.
Can't speak for me.
Yeah, okay. Well, what did you get?
My recollection.
I teach it, so if, you know, if we need to fill it in, I'll see what I can do.
That's what we're looking for. And my only sense of recollection of the story, and the read that we got so far is that Esther has to decide if she's going to reveal that she's Jewish to prevent the Jews from being killed. And she's in a place of comfort and power.
Yeah. Esther, it's a very odd story. And it's a big story in Jewish practice because it's what's called one of the festival scrolls. And it's read every year at Purim, and you act it out. It's kind of carnivalesque. It's a great time, and there's special food, and there's a pageant, kind of like what we do at Christmas time, right? You tell this story, and some little girl gets to be Esther, and another little girl has to be Vashti, and the first scene is what? It's a beauty pageant. So you have this Jewish orphan whose uncle says, oh, look, the king has turned away his old wife because she was defiant. And now he's looking for a new wife, and we'll get you all set up, and we'll send you to modeling school, and we'll get you good cosmetics, and we'll teach you how to walk and everything. So the first scene is this beauty pageant. You're thinking, this is a weird call story. This doesn't seem quite right. But then what some scholars say about Esther is that this is a novella whose purpose is to teach Jews who live in diaspora, spread out, not under their own power, that Esther is a model of faithfulness for Jews in diaspora. Because then she rises, kind of like Daniel, kind of like Joseph. She's in that category of faithfulness to a position of some power. She's not totally powerful, but, you know, she's the king's queen. And her uncle, Mordecai, discovers that there are plots to kill the Jews. And he comes to Esther and says, now, you've got to do something about this. And she's really nervous. She's kind of scared about it. And Mordecai says, who knows? If you came to your position for such a time as this, who knows? Now, is Mordecai a very clever guy? He got this all figured out. He knew what was going to happen. He got his spy in. Or does he suddenly realize? It's one of the conundrums about this story. But the reason I put it in is here's this beautiful young orphan young woman, right? And suddenly she has in her hands
the Jewish people.
Yeah. Right.
I'm like Princess Diana.
Yeah. Only more so. Even more so. It was more like if Princess Diana had been married to Hitler. I mean, it's extraordinary. Well, what do we learn about listening to God from that story? Anything?
Well, she took her life in her hands by speaking out for her people and admitting that she was also a Jew.
Okay. Sometimes it's risky. Now, of course, the people who wrote the book of Esther had never heard of Martin Luther. Right? Or Jesus, for that matter. So we want to be careful here. But there is that blessed to be a blessing dynamic. She didn't set out thinking, oh, I'm going to be this successful career woman, which being a queen was kind of the best option in those years, in order that I can save my people. She just did what her uncle told her. But the opportunity presented itself, and the position becomes less important than what the position can do for somebody else. Interesting. I don't know. That may fit somebody else's situation better than Gideon, better than Samuel, who's dedicated from his childhood. What about Jacob? This is a familiar story, I think, but I had you read lots of parts. Why do you think I had to read all those parts?
Well, I was thinking that maybe it's a story of what do you really want, or, you know, and of desire. You know, what is it you, whereas right from the beginning, Jacob wants to be number one. He's holding on, when he's born, he's holding on to his brother. And he's favored by his mother.
Gets the birthright.
Yes, you know, gets the birthright, and he struggles to be number one in that wrestling match. And it's what is blessed is, you know, you really want this. Mm. You know, maybe you don't go about it a good way. You're kind of a sneak, you know, and a manipulator. But you really want this, whereas Esau really doesn't. You know, he kind of throes it away. He squanders it.
Yeah, there's that. rest of you know Jacob's story too. You know, starts out, the first thing I read is when God speaks to Rebecca about the two nations in her womb and says the younger, well, the elder will serve the younger. So you have that. And then you have her directing Jacob to deceive the father. And then you have Jacob out there sleeping with his head on a rock, and the angel, and then up and down, and Jacob's ladder. And then after all that stuff with Laban, coming back, a little bit afraid to go across and meet Esau, and then the wrestling with the angel. One of it seems, in part it seems like desire, doesn't it? And steadfastness, he just stays on that same track, always wanting to be best. But there's also always seems to be a struggle in it. How many of you have found trying to discern God's call is like wrestling through the night? Anyone?
Because the sands are always shifting and everything.
Yeah. Oh, so it's not just through a night, it's a total pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Whereas you got it figured out and then something changes, which we have to recalculate everything.
So Gideon suggests this miraculous sign. Esther suggests a moment of clarity. Jacob suggests many acts. Right? There's this, and then there's that, and there's always trying to figure it out. What do you make of that limping business?
That was strange. I didn't.
Besides, that's why Jews don't eat that kind of meat.
Right.
Right.
What do you make of that?
What is the limping business?
Well, after, go ahead.
Well, in the struggle with the angel or the face of God, he was hit hard upon his hip socket and it was dislocated, and he limped after that. And for that reason, the Jews do not eat the meat of the hip socket. I mean, right now. We do not know.
Yeah.
But
it suggests an encounter with the holy sometimes has an effect that stays with us, and it may not always be positive. I mean that you receive some injury, some negative stuff in your personal life.
And we talk about this with vocation. You know, I start out saying, well, the first call is to follow Jesus, to take up your cross. And that kind of faithfulness, whether it's in the struggle to discern or in carrying out the task, it's risky. It was risky for Esther. Sometimes it has this kind of killing consequence that changes who we are. It maybe makes more of us. That's in her lovely novel, Evensong, Gail Godwin says, something is your vocation if it makes more of you. But more can be deeper, right? More can be wiser. More can be profounder. More can be limping. Jacob gets the new name, Israel, and he gets a limp. After all these scenes, a miraculous word, a moment of deception, a dream of reassurance, and then this at the end. A confirmation of faithfulness, but a confirmation of faithfulness that's not unmixed.
Yeah. It's not with unmixed. A permanent disability.
Yeah. Right. Right. And, you know, how we think about this, you're faithful to a relationship with someone who is ill or deranged or has some difficulty, that changes you. You know, you're never the same again. And it's probably for the good, but it's not just sunshine and light. Peter says, perhaps you are experiencing these trials so that you can have compassion. Let's look at the Luke examples. It's interesting to me, it was hard to think of examples from the New Testament that were sufficiently complex to be helpful. But here are three. What did you think of those three little bits?
Well, the people were the woman with hemorrhaging blood and Zacchaeus and the 10 lepers were all people who were at some level desperate.
Right.
Isolated from their community and desperate. So they reached out in desperation to Jesus.
Right.
They had to have been aware of Jesus. And then they made themselves close to him, physically close to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there, it's hard to sort out there what's God and what's them in a way, isn't it? How did they hear? Well, was the first hearing a gift that the woman would come and reach out, that Zacchaeus would climb up in a tree, right? So sometimes it's hard to sort that out. The theologians instruct us that God's act is always the first, right? But the way it feels isn't always that way. Sometimes it feels like we act first. But the teaching about vocation is that we hear God. We may hear God in our own longing. The longing itself may be the gift.
Well, the presence of Jesus was, in fact, God's action.
Yep.
The very presence of Jesus in those situations,
yep.
Which is true also in our lives.
And in each of these three cases, the other thing that's interesting to me is that there is that effect on me and then an action. Jesus sends the two healed persons out. Now, of course, it's because it's Luke instead of Mark, and Mark it would be different. And Zacchaeus immediately, I'm going to make reparations. So that comes back to my first point, that hearing involves acting.
I find it interesting that in all those examples, none of the people seem to have received an individual invitation. That it was more like they heard, mm-hmm. they heard that it was on the wind. Jesus was in town, and everybody in town heard that Jesus was in town, and they responded in their own way.
Right. Yeah. And we don't get. I mean, I think one of the things that happens when we look at these examples is the shorter they are, the less detail there is, the harder it is to be instructed by them.
Yeah.
Right. Which is part of the reason to look at these Old Testament Hebrew scriptures, so there's much more complexity. I'm sure you can think of other examples of biblical stories, or like Gail Godwin's novel, or dramas, or some of you heard me say yesterday, currently one of my favorite film discussions of the topic of vocation is Toy Story 2. I think it's the whole plot of Toy Story 2 is about vocational crisis. So I urge you, as you meet each other on the coffee pot and on the trail and here and there, to continue this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.